Alright, folks, welcome to Lecture 36 in this... Oh, pardon me, you know what? It's not Lecture 36, it's Lecture 38. Actually, Lecture 38. There. Okay. Well, then the Lecture 38 in this American History Program of History at Our House for the Junior and Senior High Class. Today we're going to be looking more closely at the concept of colonization, a really critical concept in terms of world history. If we look at globalization, right, we can see that it begins with and is most fundamentally related to the discovery of America by Columbus. If that doesn't happen, then there's no globalization. Because if that doesn't happen, the Portuguese get around Africa, they go to India, they're all fine and happy with that, and everybody else starts to settle in the certain pattern of trade in the old world, as it were. And, well, there's no reason to go floating off into never-never land that you have no clue how big the oceans are, how far they are. I mean, who knows when the oceans are ever going to get crossed? Because the goal of the Age of Discovery is to permit trade. And if trade begins and it flourishes, then maybe the Age of Discovery doesn't happen. And so, at that point, the Americas continue to progress on their own. And what a sad state of affairs that would be. It's kind of strange to me how a lot of people feel that it's, you know, Christopher Columbus and all the Spanish and all the English and all the French were not so nice to the natives. Well, the truth is, the natives were Neolithic barbarians. And so... whatever they were going to do, they were going to they'd probably still be living in teepees to this day. And so globalization has taken the Americas and made them the center of human civilization. That's amazing. So, yeah, it all comes down to 1492. And yes, of course, there are negatives, because people have struggled to define how to be civilized with each other. And the Europeans have struggled with that as much as anybody. But basically, globalization has caused humankind to leap forward. It's been an amazing progressive step for mankind. So that all begins with Columbus. Without him, well, we don't have this story. But beyond that, the way that the world has been shaped to a large extent, is through this next thing. So discovery is number one in terms of everything else revolves around that. If America's not discovered, there will be no colonization. But by the same token, if there's no colonization, then what else is there not? What else doesn't happen without this thing that we're now going to be studying? Without Europeans coming and settling in America, what else doesn't happen? No Europeans here? What never exists? Think anchor facts. Hand raised from Keen on the device. Go ahead, Keen.
Well, if Columbus never discovered America, then America wouldn't exist. But, you know, if people never came to America, if people knew about it, but no one ever came, America wouldn't exist either, because there would be no founding fathers to be in America to create it.
Yeah, Declaration of Independence issued by whom?
Europeans.
Yeah, by colonists. Right? So these, they were looked, and we're going to see it, they were looked down upon as colonists. They weren't, you know, the real deal. So, but anyway, there's no America without colonists. Because somebody's got to come over here and build a civilization from scratch. So, right, so this is the next phase here of our story. Is, yes, it's the discovery is indispensable. You can't have the story proceed without the discovery. But after that, you got to have the colonization part. You got to have large numbers of people being planted in the Americas and developing a civilization there. And, well, at some point, we know and we are able to predict in hindsight. I'm going to have to come up with really, really clear ways of expressing this so that you guys get your head wrapped around this concept of reverse prediction. I mean, hindsight-based prediction. We know from our anchor fact awareness that colonization is going to lead to, well, it's going to lead to conflicts. It's going to lead to problems, and we should be kind of adopting a predictive mindset that says, how does colonization take us to where we are now? How does, because we got to have the proper perspective. We're looking for information in history that tells us more about the world around us. We don't live in 1492. We don't live in 1776. We live now. So what does this have to do with us? What we need to find out is, how does this part of the story get us closer to where we are? And the answer is mainly that it gets us closer to the arrival of America. That's why this whole section of the course is called America Arrives. Because we're finally going to get there. We're going to finally get a United States of America. How does that happen? It's got to be discovered. And then there's got to be colonists coming over. And then, well, something else. We'll keep working our way towards, you know, how does a United States of America come into existence? How did it? How did it? And how did our world come to be the way that it is? How do we understand it? How was it shaped? Where is it going? What's happening? Where are we going to be living? What kind of world is it going to be? All of those are connected. So the last part there about what kind of world is it going to be, that's what we can know the answer to. When our predictive muscles are really, really strong, then we can use the information that we have about past and present to know things that haven't happened yet in advance. And there's even, I think I should post this to the class webpage. There's a really cool video on YouTube, and there's so many cool things on YouTube, of a science fiction writer named Arthur C. Clarke predicting, 40 years ago, predicting all kinds of incredible scientific advances. He's just being interviewed on television. And at the time, you know, computers could, you could barely fit a computer inside of a big room. And the display was really grainy and single color and all kinds of stuff. And this Arthur C. Clarke is telling the interviewer on television. He was a great science fiction writer. He's telling the interviewer what's going to happen. He's telling the interviewer, in the future, you're going to use your computer to buy movie tickets. In the future, you're going to use the computer to find all the information that you need. Data of libraries will be stored in the computers. And in the future, you'll do this and you'll do that. And there'll be a computer in every home. And so on and so forth. And he's just sitting there. And every single one of his predictions, he's knocking him out of the park. It's amazing to see somebody so clearly predicting what the world, what life is going to be like. And that's an amazing thing to be able to do. It's a great feeling. It gives you a kind of sense, a benevolent sense about the world, because the world makes sense to you. You don't have to feel like so many people feel in relation to the world. They don't get it. The world is too complicated and it's impenetrable. It's just so complex, and how can you understand anything about it? It's just too much. It's not. It's completely within reach if you work on it, if you practice as you're growing up and develop this predictive capacity. So that's going to continue to be part of the emphasis here, is practicing those prediction muscles so that they get stronger and stronger. And so we know that eventually we're going to get to America. We know that because we have the anchor facts. And when in doubt, think of an anchor fact. That's my piece of advice to you. If I ever asked you a question and you have no clue what the answer is, when in doubt, try for an anchor fact. Because you're more than likely get an answer there. Anchor facts are really phenomenal things. They are the most powerful facts we have at our disposal when we're studying the past. They are the facts that tell us the most of any other facts that are available in the entire history of mankind. They are the facts that tell us the most about the world around us. So something about them will help you. So in this case, we're talking about colonization and, you know, what's the big deal? Go to an anchor fact. 1776. Colonists declaring their independence. The America-centric world begins. All right, so anyway, enough on that particular segment. As excited as I am about it, we got to get going with the actual details of the concept of a colony here. So let's return to the world before colonization. There we go. Looks like that. And so the world before colonization is a world where America is an obstacle to be circumvented or circumnavigated. And until, we have this, over here we have Sir Humphrey Gilbert. He's writing an essay called A Discourse of a Discovery for a New Passage to Cathay. So he's, okay, we're still looking to get to China in 1576. Right, and we have our map of the Age of Discovery as well that shows us what we were trying to figure out the other day, what the significance of the Drake voyage is. He's going up the left side. Why? Because if there aren't any holes over here, then there aren't any holes. And by the time he gets up here, he says, I've had enough. I'm going to Asia. So they're still trying to get to Asia. And so finally we get to Richard Hakluyt with his Discourse on Western Planting in 1584. And now we're going to get colonies. And we have these variety of related concepts that we need to be clear on in order to understand this story. We have colony is the basic, concept that everything else depends on. And so make sure if you need to write notes, this one's got to be in your notes. If you're getting typed class notes, it'll be there for you. Colony is a distant territory that people from a home country settle and bring under the control of the home country. So that is a very important definition. And related to it are a bunch of other things. The process of creating colonies is colonization. And the people who organize it and direct it and fund it and do all that stuff are colonizers. And the people who get planted are colonists. So now the question is, what did Richard Hakluyt say in his Discourse on Western Planting? What did he say about why anybody should bother to do this? Well, we've got a number of reasons. He gives a lot of reasons. And so there's a few to go over, but there's one that's going to stand out above all. So we're going to kind of quickly sweep through the minor reasons and spend most of our time here on the main reason. So minor reasons. Lesser reasons that by themselves would not be enough. One was to create bases of operation for future exploration. So if you came over here and created a colony over here, well, that's already halfway across the world, right? So if you want to explore this area, better to start here, or better to start here, than to start over here. So you're sending ships from England, you're creating a colony over here, that's a place where you can be resupplied, that's a place where you can rest, and where eventually, with all your energies restored and all of your stores on the ship full again, thanks to the colonists, then you start again and you can go twice as far or go further more easily. So that was a motive that would appeal to the explorers of the day that were still trying to get to Asia via America. Right? So, okay, one reason. Another reason to create colonies was spread your particular form of Christianity to new regions. And thus, in a sense, insulate yourself and your preferred sect from the violence of Europe. Perhaps guarantee the success of your form of Christianity despite the fact that all other regios are trying to change your religio. All right, so that's reason number two, I would say. And I think I had a third one that I'm forgetting. Forgetting to look at my notes. So we got Christianity, we got a base of operations. Yeah, pretty much, let's get ready for the big one. The big one is this. The big reason to go make a colony is this. If you send people over here, let's see here, I guess I need my annotation to make nice yellow lines all over stuff. So if you send people from England over here to America, okay. Well, this is quite the place. If you think of the range of climates and the range of types of resources that you have disposable here, all the way from northern Quebec down to Florida, you're talking about an incredible range of natural resources. And so that means if you have access to that, then you send colonists over there. And what they do is they find whatever it is that people like to find through mining or in particular, for instance, certain types of forests produce the best trees for use in ships, especially your Navy ships. And you're finding a bunch of stuff that's useful. Maybe you're finding gold or other precious substances. And on top of that, you have an opportunity to make things in those, or grow foods or grow things in those climates, in those very different various climates over there, that normally you wouldn't be able to get in England except by buying them from somebody else. So if you think about the climates, for instance, compare, you know, California to Spain, you're getting a pretty similar climate. So Spain is the kind of place where if you're English and you like olives, well, you're going to have to buy them from Spain. But if you have a colony in California, well, you can get California olives. So, and if you, so what else? I don't know. Wine. There's a good one. Wine, right? The Frenchmen are the ones who are good at making wine. But again, if you have a colony in California, then the Napa Valley is going to produce some pretty amazing wines too. All right. So the point here is that you're going to substitute goods produced in your colonies for goods that you would otherwise buy from another country. Who cares? What's the big deal? What's the big deal? Why do you need to do that? If you're from England, why would you want to buy something from California instead of buying it from Spain. So I think Keane already has some experience with this topic. Let's see, anybody else? Ben, wait, want to try that one? Go ahead, Ben.
Well, if they bought her from Spain, then Spain would have more money, which means they would have more troops if they went to war.
Okay, wow, you've already leapt to a really good identification, which is true. But I wanted to work our way towards that more slowly. So, Keane, did you have something different than that?
I was going to say basically the same thing. You know, I was going to say countries, European countries especially, but, you know, people in general want to be self-sufficient. And, you know, being able to provide everything you need for yourself means that you are independent from everyone else in terms of your sustainment, and that's good.
Okay, right. I get your point. Okay. Now, that's a really interesting way of putting it, and a very common premise, and unfortunately, true, but it's let's talk about that, because it's related to the point that I wanted to make at first. So, let's talk about trade in general to understand this premise. Because, why not trade with the people from Spain? Or, let's use a better example. You're England, why not trade with the people of France? Why not? Alexander?
Because, first of all, you're worst enemies forever. And second of all, if France has a monopoly on something, then they can set the prices pretty high and you'll have to pay a lot for what you want.
All right, two good thoughts, and both of them connected to something crucial that is a feature of trade. So this is a very, potentially very profound topic for anybody who wants to be a student of history. And wants to understand the world. You can understand, and you can be a very powerful predictive, you can develop a very powerful predictive capacity by looking at trading patterns. People who trade don't kill each other. Countries who trade do not fight wars against each other. There's a fundamental difference between trade and war. And so the more trade is going on, the likelier it is that people are at peace. And in the world of globalization today, we live in a time, even though it's hard to perceive sometimes, we live in a time where the world is more at peace than it ever has been. And it's no accident that there is more trade today than the world has ever seen. They go hand in hand. Bria, go ahead.
I was going to say, can you hear me?
Bye. Yeah.
Okay, so I was going to say, if you're trading with each other, then you don't really want to lose that. If you're going to go to war, you might want to choose someone that you're not, if you like going to war.
Yeah, what do you mean by you don't want to lose that?
If you fight someone, they're likely to say you can't trade with us.
Well, yeah, sure, right? Because you're not going to trade with somebody that basically, you know, you trade with them one day and the next day they gang up on you. Right? I mean, here's the thing. There's a fundamental difference between how people look at each other in the act of trade and in the act of war. And there are two features that I want to focus on here that are really important to understand about trade. Trade is rooted in, the trade between human beings is rooted in two principles. Among others, but two wonderful positive principles. One of them is benevolence, and the other is respect. These are not quite the same things. In order to trade with somebody else, you need to be benevolent towards them, and you need to respect them. So, What are the differences here? What do these two things mean? What when you hear the word benevolence, what does that say to you? How is that a component of trade? What does it mean to be benevolent towards other people? Juliet? Well, you're getting close. That's not the same thing. To be nice is certainly, you know, a synonym, ballpark synonym. Civil, somebody said. Okay, again, ballpark synonym. Alexander?
Well, you have to, like them and know, how they're feeling so you don't do something to,
Okay, again, we're ballparking here. We're getting close. But none of those are quite right. None of those are quite sufficient. Because benevolence, you don't even have to be, you end up being kind. You end up being nice. You end up being polite. You end up being civil. You end up doing all of those things. But benevolence is deeper than those things. Benevolence is fundamentally goodwill towards others. What it means is you wish them well. You think of other human beings as fellow travelers in this life and basically a value to you. You like other people in general and you wish them well. That's goodwill, benevolence. You wish other people well. So to have a benevolent perspective is absolutely crucial to trade. We'll come back to that in a second. The other feature of it, I mean, it's the opposite of war here, right? Because, I mean, war is obviously malevolent. War means you wish other people were dead. You wish them death and you enact it, right? On a massive scale. And it's obviously the opposite of crime. It's obviously the opposite of any type of a behavior that involves the destruction of other people and their values. That's malevolent. You don't wish them well. You wish them harm. So that's malevolent, and benevolent is the opposite. You wish people well. So that's a crucial component of trade, because if you're going to trade with somebody, they have something that you want. And what do you do to get it? What's the benevolent way of getting something that somebody else has that you want versus the malevolent way of getting something that somebody else has that you want? Timothy.
Well, the benevolent way would say, I want that thing you have. How much does it cost? The malevolent thing would be to hold a gun to their face and say, give me that or I'll kill you.
Exactly. Okay. So let me just give that a little bit more precise expression. The benevolent way is, you have something that I want. What can I give you that you want in exchange? That's trade. Okay? Offer value for value. The malevolent way is, you have something that I want, give it to me, your money or your life. I'm taking it. I don't care about you. I don't wish you well. I don't feel any connection to you as a fellow human being. I'm taking it from you. That's the malevolent way. So trade is benevolent exchange. It says, if you have a value and I want it, I wish you well, so I'm going to offer you a value in exchange. So I'm going to benefit, and you're going to benefit. Now, the other component of this here is a respect for other people. In particular, a respect for their property. In order to trade with somebody, you have to have the concept of property some way in your mind. Property means you, that's yours. What's yours is yours, what's mine is mine. So if I want what you have, it's yours. I can't take it from you. That would be wrong. I respect your ownership of it. So the only way that I'm going to get it is if I find a way for you to voluntarily give that up in exchange for something else. So you have to respect the idea of property in order to trade with somebody else. What they have belongs to them and not to you. And the only way that you can get it from them is to offer them a value in exchange. So these are really crucial concepts, and you notice how just completely opposite they are. In times of war, there's obviously the fundamental mood, the fundamental posture of human beings towards each other is malevolent. They don't respect each other as fellow human beings. They want to kill each other. And there's no respect for property. Armies plunder, right? They sack cities, they steal, murder, and everything else. So there's no respect for the concept of ownership. So this is why people who are worst enemies forever don't trade, don't have a tendency to want to trade with each other, because they got too much of a history of the plunder and the sacking of each other's property, and they don't feel benevolent towards each other. It's hard for Frenchmen and Englishmen to trade, because they're always kind of, they always got a bad taste in their mouth, right, when they're doing something like that with each other. They're thinking to themselves, well, this person's not really a fellow human being. He's a Frenchman. And so not really worthy of my respect. Not really. I don't really wish him well. So it's hard for people to trade across national boundaries, especially when they have all this baggage. Right, all this psychological baggage from their history that's unresolved, they have a tendency to view each other very malevolently. So now we get to, though, this next thing that Ben was already preparing for in his comment, which has to do with money, which is an interesting problem as well. So part of the problem of trade with other countries takes, I'll describe it in very simplified form. If you're English and you buy stuff from France, well, you gotta pay them for it, right? You're buying stuff from Frenchmen. You're sending your money to France. And presumably, people in France are buying certain things from England too, and they're sending money to England. And so you're trading with each other. You're not at war. You're two trading countries for the time being. But what happens in this arrangement when the people of England have a tendency on a regular basis to buy more stuff from France than the people of France buy from England? What happens in terms of money? There's a certain amount of money in England. It's leaving for France. A certain amount of money in France and it's leaving for England. But the flows are uneven. More money is leaving than coming in, and it happens on a regular basis. Everybody should be able to do this particular experiment. Alexander?
Well, France ends up getting more money than they're giving back to England, so France has more money, and they're gaining more money, and England is losing money, relatively.
And what's the end result of this progression?
This is all the money.
All the money, yeah. If this keeps on going, if the so-called, people call this the balance of trade, if all the money is flowing from England to France, eventually there isn't any more in England. Now, how could you run out of all the money? Well, now nowadays, it's hard for us to imagine. We have such strange ways of trading nowadays, such almost magical ways, wizard-like ways of conjuring money. The government can make money out of thin air and with using computers, and it's kind of amazing. It's hard to believe. But back then, and throughout most of history, money was something very, very specific. It was something that you could hold in your hand, and that would always be the same, passed from one person to another, and it had a pure, true value. It was a physical metal, namely gold. There's only so much of it. Gold is very scarce. All the gold that has ever been mined in all of history fits in about a medium-sized swimming pool, and that's it. There's no more. So, that's it. And so, it's scarce. That's one of the reasons why it's valuable and why people use it as money. And so, in England, you had a certain amount of gold. In France, you had a certain amount of gold. And when trade didn't balance out, gold flowed from one country to another. That was the way that when money flowed, what it meant was literally that gold went from one country to another through trade. Now, Ben was leaping through to the conclusion of this development here, and what it ends up meaning is that one country's got all the gold, and this has geopolitical consequences. To go back and use a big word again. It's not just economic. It's not just that England doesn't have as much money. What do they not have now because they don't have as much money? What does it mean to have money in terms of geopolitics? In terms of how your country relates to other countries nearby? What's the danger? Ben, you already had this, so take it away. Did I confuse you with my wording?
Yeah.
Okay, so, all right, and Bria says yes as well. Thank you. It's always good for me to know. If I use words that are too convoluted, then it doesn't help, does it? All right, so here's the situation once again in a more basic characterization. England is sending its gold to France in trade, and eventually it runs out. So apart from the fact now that the French have got lots of money and they're happy, and the English don't have any and they're unhappy, what's the bigger kind of wider context here? What's the significance of all the money being in one country like this, Bria?
Well, the money is in one country, and the other person wants the money, and so the context is they're probably going to have a war to get it back.
Well, that's a pretty good guess, but in that war, who's going to have the advantage?
The French.
Why?
Because they have the money.
They have the money, right? So that means, remember what Portugal wanted to do in order to stay independent from Spain. To get money means you can buy off soldiers. And you can pay the weapons makers to make more of them. And the shipbuilders to build your navy. And so you're the one who's equipped because you can buy all the stuff that you need in order to pound your enemy into submission. So, yeah, being wealthy, all other things being equal, you know, being wealthy means you're going to be more militarily powerful. Really crucial correlation, not just correlation, but a causation, the causal link between wealth and power. Rich countries are powerful countries. You don't have to be, but if you're looking at two different countries and you look at their levels of wealth, that'll be a very important indicator in terms of how powerful they're going to be. And, you know, if you look at a modern day example, the United States and the Soviet Union were locked in a Cold War, and the United States was orders of magnitude more productive and wealthier, and ultimately the Soviet Union collapsed, and there was never a war. And they just couldn't keep up. They couldn't keep building weapons, keeping up with America that was just constantly churning out new innovations and new inventions. And the Russians, meanwhile, just couldn't even grow enough food for themselves. So, of course, they couldn't be as powerful. Economically, were in a debilitated state. So, yeah, the whole idea here is, if your money's going to France, your money's going to other countries, then you're putting them in an advantageous position. They're going to be more powerful than you. That's dangerous, because this is a world, this is not a benevolent world. This is Europe. Sorry to have to put it that way. This is not a benevolent universe. This is Europe. And what do people do in Europe? Every tribe kills every other tribe. Every different religious group kills every other different religious group, and so on. So this is not a benevolent place. So you don't feel comfortable. This goes to Keynes' point earlier about being independent. It's not really, independent is not the right word. There's an important difference here. If you are not afraid of paying other people for their products, and you're willing to trade with them on a benevolent basis, then you can be independent. Even trading with them. There's no problem. But if you live in fear of the people that you're trading with, well, now what you're seeking is to escape from that fear. Escape. And so what you want is, there's another concept for that. A fear-based independence, and people call that autarky. And that is what you're looking for. It's not really independence. It's just a malevolent version of independence, which says, I don't want to have anything to do with other human beings. That's not independence. You know, independence is, I'm living among my fellow human beings, and I'm capable of using my own mind and my own productive capacity, and I live benevolently with others, and I trade with them. That's independence. Autarky says, everybody's an enemy. Therefore, we gotta protect ourselves. The way that we're gonna arrange things is, we're going to make colonies, and we're only going to trade between us and not have anything to do with those other people that we're afraid of. So back to the definition, right? This is the way we want to run it, because we'll bring that distant territory under our control. The home country will have control over that. And so when we make stuff, when we build stuff, and when we trade stuff between fellow Englishmen, all of that stays inside of England. Yeah, England now, the definition is bigger, right? It's a greater England that includes its colonial appendages. And we become self-sufficient. We don't have to worry about our neighbors turning on us and attacking us. But one thing that's going to happen here is that those people, those colonists, are going to leave their home country and that stifling environment of Europe and go find themselves all alone and build a life for themselves and build a new civilization from scratch. And they're not going to appreciate one particular aspect of this whole colonization concept. Having built a life for themselves, having been very independent, and having had to hack their life out of the wilderness, there's something they're not going to like about this. They're not going to like the way the home country looks at them. Not as being independent human beings who have a right to their own property and who are benevolently thought of as people in their own right, but rather as components of the home country's well-being, whose reason for existing is to serve the home country. And, well, we know where this is going. Yes, we really do. Even though, again, you're probably still wondering, I do know where it's going? Yes, you do. Where is this problem leading us? One last time, let's try to summon our predictive muscles. Alexander?
The Declaration of Independence.
Okay, why?
Because they don't want to be under the control of the home country, so they declare independence from the home country.
Alright, wasn't hard, was it? Exactly. The structure of it is very straightforward when you have access to the essential notions here, when you really understand the basics. And so colonization, in the way that it was done by European countries, was at some point going to lead to independence. Now, the good thing is it's going to have more to it than just independence. It's going to be something more positive about this. So it's going to be the good part. Is there's something about these English colonists that's special. Anyway, we'll get back to that on Monday. So, you can mull this over and think about colonization, how it's connected to us now. And hopefully I will get the final writing submissions. Whoops, sorry. Final writing submissions so that we can do some more discussions about those and keep going. Tomorrow, of course, is History Through Art. So that'll do it. Bye for now, folks. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye.